reason. Emotion is also necessary for both reasoning and learning. Emotion is the source of both success and failure at selecting correct action at the crucial moment. To survive, you must develop secondary emotions that function in a strategic balance with reason. One way to promote that balance is through humor. Every pursuit has its own subculture, from hang gliders and steep creek boaters to cavers and mountain bikers. I love their dark and private humor, those ritual moments of homage to the organism, which return us to a protective state of cool. It unequivocally separates the living from the dead. When I was fighting fires with the Chicago Fire Department trying to learn something about how to be cool while going up in flames, I asked one of the men why he became a firefighter. "I like to wreck things," he said. As we smashed windows after putting out a house fire, I believed him, too. We had an old-timer at the firehouse I was working out of, Bernie was his name, who wouldn't even put on his Kevlar turnout coat. He'd fall asleep in the truck on the way to a fire, and when one of us commented on it, Bernie said, "I could sleep with my dick slammed in a door." Bernie wasn't the only one, either. The guys called the big beer cooler in the kitchen the baby coffin. They had dozens of names for different types of corpses. Crispy critters, stinkers, floaters, dunkers, and headless horsemen, just to name a few. Butch Farabee, National Emergency Services Coordinator for the National Park Service, told of taking his friend, Walt Dabney, on his first body recovery in Yosemite. There are a lot of them. They found the man they were looking for, Rick, after he'd been dead a week. "It was just terrible," Farabee said. "His body was quivering with maggots. He was as stiff as a basted turkey, too. We had to break his arms to get him into the body bag. When we lowered the body bag over a cliff, we dropped him. Walt and I had to spend the night out there with the body. I started talking to it, saying, 'Hey, Rick, how's it going today? Sorry about dropping you.' Walt thought I was either terribly disrespectful or out of my gourd. The fact is, you have to deal with these things to the best of your ability. If you don't work with it, it'll get you. A dead body is not something you get used to." Some high-angle rescue workers call body bags long-term bivy sacks. It sounds cruel, but survivors laugh and play. And even in the most horrible situations, perhaps especially in those situations, they continue to laugh and play. To deal with reality, you must first recognize it as such. And as Siebert and others have pointed out, play puts a person in touch with his environment, while laughter makes the feeling of being threatened manageable. The grotesque humor of the fighter pilots, then, that secret language, contains truths we don't even know we know. Moods are contagious, and the emotional states involved with smiling, humor, and laughter are among the most contagious of all. Laughter doesn't take conscious thought. It's automatic, and one person laughing or smiling induces the same reaction in others. Laughter stimulates the left prefrontal cortex, an area in the brain that helps us to feel good and to be motivated. That stimulation alleviates anxiety and frustration. There is evidence that laughter can send chemical signals to actively inhibit the firing of nerves in the amygdala, thereby dampening fear. Laughter, then, can help to temper negative emotions. And while all this might seem of purely academic interest, it could prove helpful when your partner breaks his leg at 19,000 feet in a blizzard on a Peruvian mountain. It is not a lack of fear that separates elite performers from the rest of us. They're afraid, too, but they're not overwhelmed by it. They manage fear. They use it to focus on taking correct action. Mike Tyson's trainer, Cus D'Amato, said, "Fear is like fire. It can cook for you. It can heat your house, or it can burn you down." And Tyson himself said that fear was like a snap, a little snap of light I get when I fight. "I love that feeling. It makes me feel secure and confident. It suddenly makes everything explosive. It's like, here it comes again. Here's my buddy today." It's a dangerous place to be, too. Control can easily slip away, as Tyson's unusual behavior will attest. I've spent the better part of my life working around people who risk dying a horrible death of their own making. They see it. They are near it. They all have friends who have gone that way, and they all have a strategy for avoiding it, a strange amalgam of superstition, knowledge, illusion, and confidence. But everyone begins with the same machinery, the same basic organism, and when it's threatened, whether in pursuit of pleasure, for duty and honor, or by accident, the organism reacts in predictable ways. It is only by managing and working with those predictable inborn reactions that you're going to survive. You can't fight them, because they are who you are. Right before the planes launched off the Carl Vinson, following the 1800 briefing in Ready 9, I went to dinner with Mike Yankovich and a group of flyers in the officers' mess, ensuring that we'd have that knot in our stomachs. After we'd finished eating, a waiter in a white coat came to the table, and every officer sitting around me said one word to him, "Dog." When they'd finished, the waiter turned to me and asked, "Dog, sir?" "Sure," I said. Then, as the waiter left, I asked Mike, "What's dog?" "Auto dog," he said. "It's soft-serve ice cream, like Dairy Queen." I asked why it was called dog. "Go over and watch it come out of the machine," he said. Survival, then, is about being cool. It's about laughing with an attitude of bold humility in the face of something terrifying. It's about knowing the deepest processes of the brain, even if, as non-scientists, we can explain them only through the darkest humor imaginable. So here they are, these F-18 pilots, about to go up and possibly die doing something horribly risky in the unholy night. And they are joking that for dessert they eat feces. It's an old habit. Remark wrote, "We make grim, coarse jests about it. When a man dies, then we say he has nipped off his turd, and so we speak of everything. That keeps us from going mad. As long as we take it that way, we maintain our own resistance." An hour after dinner, I stand on the LSO platform and Yankovich holds the pickle switch high, the heavy telephone handset pressed to his ear. We watch a nervous pilot come wobbling in. I haven't even mentioned the remarkable skill and perception it takes for Yankovich to know, by eyeball alone in the asphalt night, whether or not the black bat we see unfolding before us is going to hit the correct wire. But this pilot's approach looks really bad. Even I can tell. Through my headphones, I hear Yankovich say, "Look out, here comes Ray Charles." As he releases the pickle switch trigger to send the pilot around for another try, Yankovich does a few dance steps, his head lolling around like a blind man's, reeling there on the tiny LSO platform 7 stories above the heaving of the meterless sea. Yankovich and I turn and watch the jet shoot off the other end of the boat, engines roaring. The plane dips a bit, and we wait until it's securely back in the air. Then Yankovich says to me, "Boy, did you see him settle? He'll be picking the seat cushion out of his asshole about now." 2. Memories of the Future. A group of 20 snowmobilers had just completed a search and rescue mission to bring out 3 others who'd had engine trouble and become stranded overnight at Middle Kootenay Pass in Alberta, Canada. After successfully locating the 3, 8 of the rescuers sped off to return them to civilization, while the remaining dozen mucked about in the snow with a broken machine. On the way back, an additional fragmentation of that group occurred, because 8 of the dozen had been seized by the need for speed and just raced on ahead. They eventually stopped to wait for their slower companions. They were at an old well site, sitting on their snow machines on a broad, flat area beneath a hill. The hill was well known as a great one for hill climbing, which is also called hammerheading or high marking. The idea is to accelerate across the flat terrain and race up the hill as fast as you can until gravity stops you or until you turn back downhill. It's a competitive game to see who can go the highest. The official report would eventually remind us that they had all been specifically told that there was a high avalanche danger and that high marking or hammerheading was out of the question that day. But sitting there in the chill air with the view and the spicy juniper smell of the mountains was intoxicating. The big wide clearing led up to tremendous vaulted peaks, which seemed to leap through the gently falling snow and into the low deck of clouds like a ramp to heaven. The desire to ride a fast, open machine such as a motorcycle or a snowmobile is evidence of a certain propensity toward sensation-seeking, as the psychologists call it. In addition, that particular group had demonstrated poor impulse control, boldness, or a willingness to take risks, if you like, by racing ahead of the others. Now there they were, with their throttles in their fists and all that physical power ready at a touch. There was more sensory input to urge them on, the throaty animal roar of the engines, the horsepower throbbing between their thighs. There was Mother Nature rising into the gauzy curtains of falling snow, which both concealed and revealed her great, concupiscent backside in the swaying fabric of the clouds. Suddenly, something clicked in one of their brains. The others watched, startled, as he cut loose, flat out, across the open ground. He could feel the spinning cleats dig in, as the G's loaded up in his center of mass. It was a familiar, solid feeling of power as he was propelled up and up and up the slope across the 5 inches of new snow that had fallen in the last 2 days, which lay on top of 2 inches of rain-saturated snowpack, which in turn sat on another 2 feet of snow that had accumulated in the past 2 months. All of that was balanced precariously on top of a weak layer of faceted, wet grains, which are peculiar formations in nature with roughly the friction coefficient of tiny ball bearings. The whole system was angled downward at about 35 degrees, which happens to be the critical angle at which most avalanches occur. On steeper slopes, the snow tends to slide off before it can consolidate into a slab. On shallower ones, it remains fairly stable. The snowmobiler hadn't quite reached the top of the hill when he became bogged down in deep snow. The others below could see him up there like a ballistic nylon bug against the creamy white flank of the mountain, and could hear the faint buzzing of his engine as he struggled to get free. The thrill of the hunt, like so many moods, was contagious. A second snowmobiler goosed his engine too, and went hell-bent for high ground, right up the crack in Mother Nature's fine white fanny. It was about 20 minutes to noon, and some of the others must have been wondering, what are they thinking? The second snowmobiler had nearly reached his buddy with this vague, half-formed idea in his head of what he was doing, and this little voice way off saying, high avalanche danger and hammerheading is out of the question. It seemed almost as if he had two brains, and they were having an argument over his body. Now, those who were still waiting below could read the tally like a great natural scoreboard. The first streak going straight up and ending in a kind of blob, a hole, and the second one growing longer and longer as the roar of the engine dwindled to a faint buzzing and the black bug grew small against the white slope. Then they heard the rifle shot crack that typically accompanies the release of a big slab avalanche. According to the official report, at about 11:40, Snowmobiler 2 also sped up the slope, and when he was about two-thirds of the way up, a size 3 avalanche released. Snowmobiler 2 was able to ride out to the side of the avalanche and escape. At the bottom of the slope, the other 6 had seen the avalanche start, and 5 of them managed to ride out of the path of the slide. But there was one guy down there who just froze. The avalanche released a 450-foot-wide swath of snow, 32 inches thick, all the way from the top of the ridge. Once it started, it rushed down 400 yards, cascading on those ball-bearing grains like 8 lanes of concrete interstate highway, sloughing off in an old-fashioned San Francisco earthquake. The first man, the one who became bogged down, was swept all the way down the hill and covered by 9 feet of snow. But the poor guy down below, the one who froze, he watched, probably mystified, as that wall of snow inundated him in 6 feet of snow like wet concrete. Freezing is a classic emotional response of all mammals. A bystander happened to be videotaping the crowd when a bomb went off at the Olympic Games in Atlanta in 1996, and the freezing and crouching response of the people is a dramatic illustration of a primary emotion. The snowmobilers were all wearing transceivers, radio devices meant for locating victims buried by avalanches. So they obviously had some knowledge of the phenomenon, even apart from the warning they'd received. They may, for example, have known that to be buried under even a few inches of snow is a dodgy proposition. Snow is very heavy and sets up in seconds after the avalanche stops moving. The faceted grains refracture as the snow slides and then interlock tightly when they come to rest. The slope, in this case, dumped 2 million pounds of snow into a terrain trap. Because they had transceivers, those who were not buried were able to locate the victims immediately, which is a good first step in avalanche rescue. In addition, help from the nearby ski area arrived within minutes at 11:55 a.m. Most victims don't get attention that quickly. But digging 6 to 9 feet of wet snow out of an avalanche deposit, even with everyone there and all the catecholamines pumping, is like digging up a city sidewalk. It took 25 minutes to uncover Snowmobiler 3, the one who'd been sitting there flat-footed at the bottom of the hill, gaping up in wonder as the whole mountain came apart before his eyes. He was, of course, blue and not breathing. Snowmobiler 1 wasn't dug up for 40 minutes. By then, a doctor had arrived to pronounce the two officially dead at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the day before Valentine's Day, 1994. The report added, "One of the original search party afterwards questioned, 'Why did they do it? We were told not to.'" Why indeed? As William Faulkner wrote in Light in August, "Man knows so little about his fellows. In his eyes, all men or women act upon what he believes would motivate him if he were mad enough to do what that other man or woman is doing." But in the light of recent research, neuroscience can propose a better answer to the question that is asked so often after such accidents: what were they thinking? You have to begin by asking why anyone would want to ride a snowmobile in the first place. It's not as if they had somewhere to go. They did, but it wasn't up that hill. You have to ask what could possibly motivate a rational, well-informed person to ride up a slope when he knew that all he could do was come straight back down, having burned through some expensive fossil fuel. The answer would seem self-evident. It's fun. But then you need to know what makes a completely pointless activity fun. If, as the research tells us, all behavior can be traced to survival strategies, you must ask where the survival value is in that act. We know, for example, why sex is fun. It keeps the species going. If it weren't irresistible, no one would be mad enough to do it. But modern neuroscience would explain it another way. Like Remarque's soldiers throwing themselves down without thinking at the faintest whistling of an incoming shell, the snowmobilers who went up the hill were acting out a secondary emotion. They had developed it by experiencing it, by synaptic learning. Perhaps it was an emotion that motivates running down prey, a thrilling bodily response that requires speed and swift action to pursue, catch, and kill. Perhaps it was an emotion involved with mating. Perhaps several emotional states were pulled together into a new combination, a heady elixir of chemicals that pour forth when one rides a snowmobile. Since young, brain-dead male motorcycle riders supply many of the hearts transplanted in the United States, we know that the same is likely true of that experience. As generic as emotions tend to be at some levels, the important point is the feeling that resulted and the fact that it was instantly available without conscious thought. There's a common confusion about the words emotion and feeling. William James, the father of psychology, was the first to point out that we do not run because we're afraid of bears. We're afraid of bears because we run. The emotion comes first. It's the bodily response, freezing, flight, sexual arousal. The feeling follows, fear, anger, love. The fear associated with being in an earthquake may produce some chemical reactions that are similar to those produced during sexual arousal, but the two experiences are quite different. The earth moved can have different meanings in different circumstances. That's why risky behavior can be fun. Fear can be fun. It can make you feel more alive because it is an integral part of saving your own life. And if the context is one that you perceive as safe, then it's easy to make the decision to take the risk. Your body can make it for you. But killing yourself is no fun, and so you still have to ask why, when the snowmobilers knew how high the chance of an avalanche was, they decided to take the risk anyway. Even though it is now possible to understand why going up the hill would be fun, it's still not clear how those two who ran up the hill made that decision when they knew it was likely to kill them. Think of chess masters and how they play. Let's imagine that life is a board game. Some people like to play checkers, some people like to play chess. And those of us who go into the wilderness and engage in dangerous sports are playing chess with Mother Nature. A computer uses pure logic to play, trying millions of conceivable moves, not every move, but known patterns of moves put in by chess-playing programmers. People not only don't do that, they can't. In fact, neither people nor computers can play chess by logic alone. There are only a few simple rules to the game, but an estimated 10 to the 120th power possible moves in any game of chess. That number is so large that it might as well be infinite. As James Gleick pointed out in his book Chaos, there are neither that many elementary particles in the universe, nor have there been that many microseconds of time since its creation, perhaps 13 billion, 1.3 times 10 to the 9th power years ago. Logic doesn't work well for such nonlinear systems as chess and life. So, there they are, in the board game of life, with billions of bits of information stored and new ones coming in fast and furious, and they're at a decision point. How do they decide what to do? The act of riding a snowmobile up a steep hill had come to elicit an emotional response. Those riders had done it before and had been rewarded with a good feeling. It was a physical feeling, and the body liked it. So it was bookmarked, so to speak. Note to self, try hammerheading again. The brain creates such bookmarks, technically known as somatic markers, a term coined by Antonio Damasio, because logic and reason are much too slow if we are to get around in this big old goofy world. Consider what eating would be like if you used a purely deductive process. Say your brain suddenly turned into a computer and had only logic to work with. It's Sunday afternoon. You're sitting at your desk in your study at home catching up on some paperwork. You feel hungry. Here's why computers are so frustrating to people. First, you try eating the telephone. That doesn't taste good, so you try the paperweight. Bad idea. Then you gnaw on the keyboard for a while, kind of bland. Chew the edge of the desk, the chair, lick the floor. Eventually, perhaps a week later, you have gone through the house in search of food using the system of pure reason, and you reach the refrigerator. After chewing on the handle for a time, you open the door and find that there's some leftover pizza. Ah, success. It sounds ridiculous. You might say, of course I wouldn't try to eat the telephone. I know where the food is. But chimpanzees that have certain emotional components of their brains removed do something not unlike that. To have reason cut off from the high-speed, jump-cut assistance of emotion is virtually incapacitating, as many neuroscientists have shown with patients who have suffered brain damage. Those patients can perform all sorts of logical functions. They have normal memory. And yet they are incapable of scheduling an appointment because their pure reason makes it impossible for them to decide. They can't bookmark feelings. They have no intuition, no gut feelings. They've been cut off from their bodies, in a sense. The most remarkable discovery of modern neuroscience is that the body controls the brain as much as the brain controls the body. most decisions are not made by using logic, which we all recognize at least at an unconscious level. Ledoux writes, "Unconscious operations of the brain is the rule rather than the exception throughout the evolutionary history of the animal kingdom, and include almost everything the brain does. In finding food, you have bookmarked a place where the good feeling of satisfying hunger comes out of opening the refrigerator door and grabbing something inside. You remember that the refrigerator is there to hold food, but you don't need to think through it. You can be on automatic pilot, reading something as you mosey over to the kitchen, open the door, and only then look up to do the conscious part, grab a slice of pizza instead of leftover Thai barbecue. The search for food occurs without anything you'd call cognition, deduction, or logic. Your hunger, your body, leads you there. When a decision to act must be made instantly, it is made through a system of emotional bookmarks. The emotional system reacts to circumstances, finds bookmarks that flag similar experiences in your past and your response to them, and allows you to recall the feelings, good or bad, of the outcomes of your actions. Those gut feelings give you an instant reading on how to behave. If a previous experience was bad, you avoid that option. When it was good, it becomes a beacon of incentive, to use Damasio's words. In a similar fashion, the smell of roses can transport me to my grandmother Rosa's house in San Antonio in 1958. You don't have to have sensory input to trigger the effect. You can have an idea or a memory instead. That instant physical feedback, those feelings that are located through emotional bookmarks, will more or less force a decision unless checked by higher consciousness. It explains why the Navy fighter pilot who was low and slow wound up hitting the stern of the aircraft carrier. He had no idea why he kept coming in the face of clear information telling him not to. Damasio wrote, "When the bad outcome connected with a given response comes into mind, however fleetingly, you experience an unpleasant gut feeling. Using that system, you can choose very quickly and may be unable to explain your choice afterward. The best and worst decisions are made that way. You don't have to think about it. It just feels right." The good feeling of riding snowmobiles had become bookmarked for instant reference by the emotional system. That activity, while irrelevant to survival, became as pleasurable as the experience of the primary emotion because it harnessed the real thing. There are no fake emotions. Because the system is designed to work without the assistance of logic or reason, there's now an answer to the question, what were they thinking? They weren't. The whole point of the system is that you don't have to think. A classic experiment was performed in Switzerland in 1911 by a psychologist named Edouard Claparède. Claparède's 47-year-old patient had no short-term memory. One day, Claparède went in and shook hands with her, as he had always done. Only this time he had a pin in his hand, which stuck her. Although she had no memory of it after a few minutes, she would never shake hands with Claparède again. She had no idea why. She just got a bad feeling when he stuck out his hand. There was some residue of her painful experience that had connected itself to the sight of Claparède sticking out his hand, and she had what in a normal person we could call an intuition, a gut feeling. A normal woman couldn't explain those feelings either, but a few milliseconds later she'd remember. Thinking logically could not assist the patient in deciding whether or not to shake Claparède's hand. But somewhere in her brain, her experience had caused her to bookmark the bad feeling of an emotion. She'd involuntarily jerked her hand back when she felt the pain. The feelings that followed the emotional response of jerking her hand back were powerful and unpleasant. Shock, surprise, fear. Certainly her heartbeat and breathing sped up. Perhaps her face flushed. She may have cried out, and although she had no conscious recollection of the events or feelings, she was forever after compelled by that emotional bookmark to select the same response. It was a momentous discovery on Claparède's part. his patient could learn without memory or thought. It was as if her body could learn. It hinted at a whole hidden system within her, the very system by which the two snowmobilers decided to rush up the hill against all reason. On the other hand, while the patient's learned response was correct in one circumstance, her lack of memory had robbed her of the ability to adapt the response for other circumstances. When there was no danger, she still jerked her hand back. A normal person would have laughed and said, "Now, Doc, you don't have a pin in your hand this time, right?" But she'd lost the flexibility that makes Homo sapiens unique in the animal world. Voluntary actions on the right side of the body begin in the motor cortex in the left hemisphere of the brain and go through the pyramidal tract, a great bunch of axons that issue from it. If you have a stroke that destroys the motor cortex, you'll be paralyzed on the right side of your body. Everything will stop working, including your facial muscles. If someone tells you to smile, you'll produce a grotesque, lopsided grimace. But if you hear something funny that causes you to laugh involuntarily, you'll produce a normal, symmetrical smile. The reason is that emotional reactions are controlled through the anterior cingulate, the medial temporal lobe, and the basal ganglia, which were not destroyed by the hypothetical stroke. That effect can be reproduced in patients with brain damage. There are at least two separate brain systems that can generate behavior. The way they work, the way you capture experiences and turn them into learning, memories, can influence your ability to survive. M. Euphemia Morphew, a psychologist and founder of the Society for Human Performance in Extreme Environments, told me of a series of accidents she'd been studying in which scuba divers were found dead with air in their tanks and perfectly functional regulators. Only they had pulled the regulators out of their mouths and drowned. It took a long time for researchers to figure out what was going on. It appears that certain people suffer an intense feeling of suffocation when their mouths are covered. That led to an overpowering impulse to uncover the mouth and nose. The victims had followed an emotional response that was in general a good one for the organism, to get air. But it was the wrong response under the special, non-natural circumstances of scuba diving. It's possible that the impulse, the feeling of suffocation, was formed as an implicit memory by some previous experience that was not available to conscious, explicit memory. And the divers had no way of knowing that the one thing that would keep them alive, covering the nose and mouth, was the one thing the organism would not tolerate. At the critical moment of decision, reason was not enough to overcome emotion. For no one would say that those divers believed they could breathe underwater without a regulator. Morphew and the other researchers wanted to know what the divers were thinking when they removed their regulators and tried to breathe without them. The answer is, you don't need to think. That's what emotions and implicit memories are all about. By tradition, reason is regarded as the highest function. People are named after it. Homo sapiens, from the Latin sapere, to taste, as in to taste the world. But from the point of view of an organism in desperate trouble, an organism that evolved by relying on emotions as the first line of defense, cognition is irrelevant and gets set aside. It's slow and clunky. As Remarque said, there's no time for it. Most of the mystifying accidents that happen in the course of risky recreation, the seemingly illogical decisions, actions, and outcomes, can be explained by the same interplay of emotions and cognition that shapes all human behavior. What the scuba divers did made perfect sense from the point of view of the organism's survival. The impulse to get air is automatic and can be overpoweringly strong. Those who can control that impulse to survive live. Those who can't die. And that's the simplest way to explain survival, whether the venue is night carrier landings or being lost in the jungle. When I was teaching my daughter Amelia how to snowboard, she caught her edge exactly twice and never did it again. When you catch the downhill edge of your snowboard, it slams you to the ground with such force you feel as if somebody just dropped a safe on you. It hurts everywhere. After the first time you do it, you have to think consciously about tensing the muscles in your leg to keep your edge up as you ride. Then you get tired, lazy, or distracted. You catch your edge again, and it practically knocks you out. Generally, after that second experience, you have developed a deeply ingrained emotional bookmark. Then, whenever you start to relax those muscles, you get a really bad feeling, like somebody's going to drop a safe on you, and those muscles tighten right up. You never have to think about it again. The elegant and seamless assistance of those bookmarked feelings is essential in using the more linear tools of logic and reason. But in certain circumstances, usually ones where we are exposed to unfamiliar or extreme hazards, it can also be a trap. 3. A map of the world. When I was a teenager, and my father could see how hard I was trying to be cool, he took me aside and gave me a little talk about the difference between being cool, which he clearly was, though he didn't say that, and acting cool, which I clearly was. I was already doing risky things, and he remarked that to die a needless death of your own making was not cool, man, not cool. One summer, some years later, I was going out on night assault maneuvers with the Army's 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg in a live-fire exercise. I was working with Army Rangers, who were some tough mothers. We spent a few days hopping in and out of helicopters, shooting off rockets, and blowing up tanks. Oh, it was great fun. But I was most interested in hearing from the Rangers about their training. It was hardcore. The training lasted 8 weeks, starting at Fort Benning in Georgia and winding up sometimes as far away as Utah. It was the most intense, demanding, and exhausting ritual the U.S. Army had. We'd just come on a night drop into sand dunes. They didn't let me jump, so I was on the ground when the planes came over. I could hear the distant chattering of automatic weapons fire somewhere in the forest, and then the faint droning hammer of the C-130 engines. The moon had not yet risen, but the Big Dipper was up in the western sky, and a big orange planet burst halfway up beyond the southern tree line as I walked out onto what seemed like desert, but had been, 10 million years before, ocean floor. The darkness was so complete that I could see nothing before me as I struggled through the sand. Then one of the stars in the southern sky resolved itself into an artificial light, and I walked toward it, knowing that it was a turn-in point for parachutes and that people would be there. As I walked toward it, I saw a planet suddenly rise half out of the eastern sky, and I watched it for a moment before I realized that I was looking at a flare. A moment later, automatic weapons ripped away, and then the heavy whoosh thud of a howitzer peeled back the pretense of solitude for a moment before night closed once more around me. There is nothing quite like the sound of a howitzer, an enormous galvanized steel door being slammed, jamming the air up into the valleys of these hills. Like a surf, the waves of air come back when they've spent all their energy out there. Then the planes came, and I saw their green and red navigation lights moving toward us along a line parallel with the drop zone. I ran to get under them as they came on and on. I reached the middle of the DZ just as they drew overhead. Everything seemed to grow silent as the stress of the moment narrowed my perceptions. The sky was light compared with the land, and against that shimmering, cold, feather-gray scrim, I saw the dark leviathan shapes of the ships crossing to the south. Without warning, a blossoming profusion of jellyfish sprayed out across the sky. Silently and swiftly they grew, from black points in the sky to the swelling, round, living atoms of darkness filling in the spaces between the stars. Now the planes were gone, and truly there was no sound at all except my heart hammering. As I stumbled on the ocean floor, watching scores of the creatures come down all around me, I knew that one must surely drift down on top of me and engulf me in the trembling petals of its mushroom flesh. I could see, as they descended in the fluid of the air, that men were dangling from them. Within 100 feet of the ground, each man pulled the release that dropped his rucksack to dangle on a 15-foot lanyard, and all around me now I heard the snap-clatter swishing of the packs as they hit and the men prepared to land. Just beside me, the first man landed hard, and I heard his oof, and saw the gray jellyfish above him balloon and invert, dumping its bubble of air, then drift and fold and lie down quietly on the sand. "Oh, God, I've got to piss," the man groaned, and I heard the clanking of his gear as he tried to free himself of hasps and clips and webbing. His face came up, and I could see him just well enough in the dim light to recognize him. It was a guy they were calling Buddy. When we were gearing up for the drop, zipping speed loaders into the M16 clips, spacing them with red phosphorus tracer rounds, and unpacking mortar rounds to stuff into butt packs, I'd seen Buddy down on his knees cradling a claymore mine. A claymore is a modern version of the stand of grapeshot, a fiberglass shell filled with plastic explosive mixed with 700 steel ball bearings. It's rectangular, about 6 by 10 inches, 1.5 inches thick, dull silver-colored, curved from side to side, with pointed metal legs that fold down from underneath so that it can be stuck into the ground like a miniature drive-in movie screen. When it's fired, that load of grapeshot sprays out, supersonic and molten, and anyone within a 325-foot swatch is reduced, as the Rangers like to say, to hamburger helper. I'd been playing with the switch on a mortar round, flipping it from proximity to impact, when I looked over and saw Buddy with his face against the claymore, a cigarette in his mouth, smelling it. I went over to see what madness motivated him to do that, and he looked up, smiled at me dreamily, and said, I love the smell of a claymore. I got down and cradled it to my face and smelled it too. It smelled like cherries. Now, on the DZ, as all the men landed around us, first the rucksacks crunched, then the man, hitting and rolling as best he could, encumbered as he was with live rounds, rockets, high explosives, claymores, grenades, flares, and then the great weight of the parachute itself, the sea creature that carried him here, dying in the dead air on the ancient shore, I heard one man say as he drifted down toward me, "Look out, son, I'm going to explode on impact." Then I was humping through the forest in the middle of the night with a 40-pound pack, talking with Colonel Robert Loschus, who'd gone through it. He was a ranger. This night, for him, was just a picnic. He told me that after a week or two in ranger training, he'd begun to hallucinate, an experience often reported by survivors. The colonel's ration had been 2 MREs, meals ready to eat, every 3 days, which is to say he was slowly starving. He lost 30 pounds in 58 days. There was sleep deprivation and an escalating series of trials, forced marches, free-climbing sheer cliffs without ropes, and being thrown into the snake and alligator-infested swamps in Florida to find his way out on his own. Fear of death, fear of height, fear of dark, fear of drowning, all combined to make him descend deeper and deeper into himself and find what was there. To change it. To build it. Some say to put it to sleep. Others say to wake it up. I left Fort Bragg thinking that of all the people I'd known, certainly a ranger would be the most likely to survive the hazards of nature. But the training is only as good as the environment. On September 6, 1997, Captain James Gaba, an Army Ranger, was taking a guided commercial rafting trip down the upper Gauley River in West Virginia when the raft hit a rock. Gaba, 36, was thrown from the raft, and his guide, trying to save him, fell in too. The guide tried to rescue Gaba, but Captain Gaba just laughed and pushed him away. Gaba floated calmly downstream, and if he was anything like the Rangers I'd known, he must have felt that he was in no real danger because of all the training he'd had under much worse conditions. He must have felt good, too, masterful, confident. He'd eaten, he'd slept. Hell, he could do this until the wheels came off. Then he arrived at a place where a big rock blocked the middle of the current. Gaba was sucked under, pinned, and drowned. The official report said, the guest clearly did not take the situation seriously. But that's not true. He took it very seriously. It's easy to see hubris in Gaba's behavior, but it's more subtle than that. Everyone carries around a necessary measure of his environment and of the self. From conception onward, the organism defines what is self and what is not. The immune system examines materials from the environment to assess whether they are a threat or harmless. Cells within that system hold up proteins in an almost ritualistic way so that T cells can read them and see if they are self or foreign. If a T cell recognizes the protein as self, it commits suicide. If the protein is unfamiliar, the T cell gives the B cell permission to create an antibody, which helps mobilize an attack to destroy the invading protein. In that and other ways, the immune system continuously rearranges the organism's relationship to its environment. That's called adaptation. A lifetime of experience builds the system, but a subtle change in the environment can mean that the system no longer has the correct response. It's suddenly out of adjustment. For example, when Europeans brought unfamiliar diseases west with them in the 1500s, the previously healthy and thriving Native Americans were rapidly wiped out. But some creatures are amazingly adaptable. At the beginning of summer, I used to have hundreds of crows circling my house at dawn, barking noisily. Then one morning, they were all gone. They'd been threatened by the West Nile virus. They went away for months. Now they're back. Crows are survivors. The emotions are another mechanism for defining self, actually creating the self, during the process of protecting what is within from what is without, both by avoiding or fighting what is bad, and by seeking out what is good. As Joseph Ledoux put it, people don't come preassembled, but are glued together by life. Like the immune system, the emotional system evolves continuously, taking experiences and situations and attaching emotional value to them in subtle gradations of risk and reward. Children begin learning even before birth, and near the end of pregnancy their brains may be forming as many as 250,000 new nerve cells a minute. Scientists estimate that the mature brain has 100 billion neurons and trillions of connections. Once infants begin moving about in the world, they engage in a process of trial and error by which they find out how much risk they can take to reap a given amount of reward. Every experience adds to the body of knowledge and shapes future behavior. Children constantly test and sample their environment and themselves, taking risks that give big rewards without too much exposure. It's a delicate, often beautiful balancing act. I watched my newborn son Jonas learn to cry on purpose. In animal terms, you can view crying as a risk because it attracts attention, and there's no way for the infant to know if that attention is going to be good or bad. At first, he'd only cry when something bothered him. Discomfort, pain, hunger. And you could tell by the sound of the cry that it was genuine and loud. Each time he cried, however, his mother held him, and most times she fed him, too, or changed his diaper. Soon Jonas learned that if he wanted some sort of attention, he could cry. And it was a different cry, with none of the urgent, shrieking qualities it had before. It was more a whimper, and he used it effectively to get what he needed or wanted. Moderate stress enhances learning. When two neurons fire together, they become wired together. When a strong and weak neuron, call them Al and Betty, stimulate a third neuron, call it Charlie, at the same time, the weak one, Betty, gains the ability to stimulate Charlie to fire. That's why the ringing of a bell could cause Pavlov's dog to salivate even when there was no food present. Scientists, with their ever-playful juggling of three or four languages at once, call that long-term potentiation, LTP. So risk is an integral part of life and learning. A baby who doesn't walk, for example, will never risk falling. But in exchange for taking that risk, he gains the much greater survival advantage of being bipedal and having his hands free. That's another reason play becomes important to most people. That's why we go out there and do the things we do in the wilderness. Amelia could have refused to snowboard after her first painful fall. But in exchange for the risk, she gets to have the emotional rush of zinging down a mountain and catching some fat air with the old man. She also gets to wear cool snowboarding clothes to attract boys, so perhaps there is survival value in it too, at least for the species. The knowledge involved in that risk-reward loop does not involve reasoning. It comes to the child coded in feelings, which represent emotional experiences in a particular environment. If the environment changes, if it has unfamiliar or subtly different hazards, those adaptations may turn out to be inappropriate. Logic simply takes too long, often impossibly long. And in a child, logic is not well developed enough at any rate. Instead, he rapidly and unconsciously pages through his atlas of emotional bookmarks, probably an instance of LTP. Numerous neural networks, associations that connect the situation he's in with similar situations or experiences from the past, flicker with electrochemical energy, illuminating memories and feelings of circumstances and actions that led to good and bad outcomes, projecting forward to future paths of action and feeling. Jonas is forming a dynamic map of himself, his world, and his experiences in it, and is sending projections through time in the form of images of the future. In a sense, he can see down his own path by the light of that circuitry. The emotional map of the world, with him in it, is doing its work all the time, essential as a heartbeat to his survival. His work had only just begun. Years later, he might be sitting quietly at home, and that system will be doing another kind of work, perhaps helping him to decide whether to read War and Peace or eat ice cream. If he ever falls into a fast-moving river, that system will be doing a much more urgent sort of work. And if he's had the right experiences, it will instantly direct correct action. If you could see the brain working, if it gave off light as it worked, then at a decision point, different areas would begin glowing all over like the lights of cities going on at dusk as seen from the space shuttle. The patterns contained in those networks, formed from unique experiences of life, inform decisions at a rate of speed that can never be achieved by logic. And all of this takes place in the shadow land just beyond conscious thought. Most people who fall into swift water would welcome rescue. But Captain Gabba, the Army Ranger, may have set himself up for disaster through extreme experiences in extreme environments. As a ranger, Gabba had had experiences that seemed more hostile than a guided river tour. He'd not only taken care of himself, but if the stories told me by other rangers are any indication, he came away feeling more alive than he'd ever felt. Worse, in ranger culture, having to be rescued is ignominious. It is associated with a bad outcome, shame, failure. In ranger training, if you have to be rescued, you are out of the program. The emotional bookmarks that Gabba developed had labeled rescue as bad, and self-sufficiency and even pain as good, no matter how threatening the environment. His training and experience taught him that it was better to die for his country than to fail. Death before dishonor. Rangers lead the way, they don't follow. The training worked. The Canadian snowmobilers suffered a similar consequence stemming from emotional bookmarks. The first snowmobiler who went up the hill had the abstract concept of an avalanche idling around in the front part of the brain, looking for something physical, i.e. emotional, to attach itself to. Unfortunately, it found nothing in the Atlas of Experience. His emotional map of the world contained no feelings about avalanches because his body had had no experience of them. On the other hand, he had clear perceptions to help find an emotional bookmark. The mountain and environs, the noisy snowmobile. For example, he may have smelled the pine forest, and it was the same smell he'd noticed the last time he tried hammerheading, and when he did, he got this boss feeling. He had the bodily memory of pleasure from previous runs. One was an abstraction, the other a physical certainty, clearly illuminated within his emotional map and signaling deeply instinctive behaviors. If you don't hunt, you don't eat, for example. Certainly there were other factors. the masterful feeling of being the rescuer and the speed of riding ahead to that beautiful spot in the woods, not to mention, perhaps, fatigue, dehydration, an earlier bout with anxiety about their lost friends, the relief of finding them, the whew factor in which you let down your guard once you feel safe. All of those influences, too, must have conspired to derail the efforts of reason to constrain action. There was another more fundamental difficulty that the snowmobilers faced. Our sense of a mountain, the earth, is a sense of something solid, and our experience confirms that. Nothing in our learning tells us that a mountain is going to come apart before our eyes. It makes no sense. It hasn't happened, therefore it cannot happen. The mountain certainly didn't look fragile. The snowmobilers literally couldn't believe it. We think we believe what we know, but we only truly believe what we feel. Only in recent years has neuroscience begun to understand the detailed physiology of emotional states such as fear. The neocortex is responsible for your IQ, your conscious decisions, your analytical abilities. But the amygdala stands as a sort of watchdog for the organism. Amelia, who is the younger of my two daughters, has a chocolate lab, Lucy. Lucy sometimes reminds me of the amygdala. When anyone comes to the door, she barks before I even hear it. Perceptions from the world around us, sight for example, reach the thalamus first. In the case of vision, axons from the retina go to the visual thalamus. There are two, one in each side of the brain, receiving information from each side of the body. From there, the sight signals travel by way of axons from the visual thalamus to the middle layer of the neocortex, and from there are sent out to the other five layers for processing. What emerges is a perception of sight. But before all that can be completed, a rough form of the same sensory information reaches the amygdala by a faster pathway. The amygdala screens that information for signs of danger. Like Lucy, the amygdala isn't very bright, but if it detects a hazard, or anything remotely resembling one, before you're even conscious of the stimulus, it initiates a series of emergency reactions. The approach is better safe than sorry. Unlike Lucy, the amygdala is also capable of ignoring a lot of information as irrelevant. It is a primitive but effective survival system that causes the rabbit that visits our backyard every morning to freeze and then run when she sees Amelia let Lucy out. Like Lucy, the amygdala is wrong a lot of the time. There is no danger. But in the long course of evolution, it has been a successful strategy. So information from the senses takes a neural route that splits, one part reaching the amygdala first, the other arriving at the neocortex milliseconds later. Rational or conscious thought always lags behind the emotional reaction. Anyone can demonstrate this at home. Everyone has been startled by someone. It's a powerful response, marked by the familiar rocket rush of adrenaline, actually catecholamines, increased heart rate, flushing, and panting. Then, as soon as you realize the person is someone you know, the response de-escalates. But it takes a while to metabolize all those chemicals. It's a powerful emergency reaction, and completely illogical, because you know the person and are not in any danger. But the reason you can't think of that logically before reacting is because the visual signals reach the amygdala first. It's a big, shadowy form. It could be a spouse. It could be a bear. You don't know. Only later, in milliseconds, does the visual cortex piece together an accurate picture that lets you in on who it is. Only later can you reason, no bears in this house. While the pathways from the amygdala to the neocortex are stronger and faster than the ones going the other way, some ability may remain for the neocortex to do the following. First, to recognize that there is an emotional response underway. Second, to read reality and perceive circumstances correctly. Third, to override or modulate the automatic reaction if it is an inappropriate one. And fourth, to select a correct course of action. Since emotions are designed to elicit behaviors in a split second, clearly that is a tall order, and some people are much better at it than others. In addition, there is a wide variation in individual reactions. Some people startle easily. Others tend not to react at all. Some people function better under stress, such as professional